Chapter 59. Military Engines. Journal of the Expedition Against the Insurgents, kept by William Tryon, Governor. Thursday, May the 2nd. The Craven and Carteret detachments marched out of New Bern with the two field pieces, 6 swivel guns mounted on carriages, 16 wagons and 4 carts loaded with baggage, ammunition, and as much provisions as would supply the several detachments that were to join them on their route to Colonel Bryan's, the place of general rendezvous. The governor left New Bern the 27th of April and arrived at Colonel Bryan's the 1st of May. Today, the troops from the two districts joined. Friday, 3rd of May, Union Camp. The governor reviewed at 12 o'clock the detachments in the meadow at Smith's Ferry on the west side of Neuse River. Saturday, the 4th of May. The whole march to Johnston Courthouse, 9 miles. Sunday, 5th of May. March to Major Theophilus Hunter's in Wake County, 13 miles. Monday, 6th of May. The army halted, and the governor reviewed the Wake regiment at a general muster. Mr. Hinton, colonel of the regiment, acquainted the governor that he had got but 22 men of the company he had received orders to raise, owing to a disaffection among the inhabitants of the county. The governor, observing a general discontent in the Wake regiment as he passed along the front rank of the battalion, seeing that not more than 1 man in 5 had arms, and finding that upon his calling on them to turn out as volunteers in the service, they refused to obey, ordered the army to surround the battalion, which being effected, he directed 3 of his colonels to draft out 40 of the most sightly and most active men, which manoeuvre caused no small panic in the regiment, consisting at the time of about 400 men. During the drafting, the officers of the army were active in persuading the men to enlist, and in less than 2 hours completed the Wake company to 50 men. Night coming on, the Wake regiment was dismissed, much ashamed both of their disgrace and their own conduct which occasioned it. The army returned to camp. Wednesday, the 8th of May. Colonel Hinton's detachment was left behind with a view to prevent the disaffected in that county from forming into a body and joining the regulators in the adjacent counties. This morning, a detachment marched to the dwelling house of Turner Tomlinson, a notorious regulator, and brought him prisoner to camp, where he was closely confined. He confessed he was a regulator, but would make no discoveries. The army marched and encamped near Booth's on New Hope Creek. Friday, the 10th of May. Halted, ordered the wagons to be refitted, horses to be shod, and everything put in repair. Reviewed in Hillsborough 2 companies of the Orange Militia. The prisoner Tomlinson made his escape this evening from the quarter guard. Detachments set after him, but without success. Sunday, the 12th of May. Marched and forded Haw River and encamped on the west side of the banks. It was expected the regulators would have opposed the passages of the Royalists over this river, as it was their intent, but not suspecting that the army would move out of Hillsborough till after Monday, they were, by this sudden movement of the army, defeated in that part of their plan. Received this day flying reports that General Waddell was forced by the regulators, with the troops under his command, to repass the Yadkin River. Divine service, with the sermon performed by the Reverend Mr. McCartney. Text. If you have no sword, sell your garment and buy one. This day, 20 gentlemen volunteers joined the army, chiefly from Granville and Butte counties. They were formed into a troop of light horse under the command of Major MacDonald. A regulator, taken by the flanking parties, laying in ambush with his gun. Commissary took out of his house part of a hogshead of rum lodged there for the use of the regulators. Also some hogs which were to be accounted to his family. Monday, the 13th of May. Marched to O'Neill. At 12 o'clock, an express rider from General Waddell with a verbal message, the express not daring to take a letter for fear of its being intercepted. the purport of which message was that on Thursday evening, the 9th instant, the regulators to the number of 2,000 surrounded his camp and in the most daring and insolent manner required the general to retreat with the troops over the Yadkin River, of which he was then within 2 miles. He refused to comply, insisting he had the governor's orders to proceed. This made them more insolent, and with many Indian shouts they endeavoured to intimidate his men. The general, finding his men not exceeding 300, and generally unwilling to engage, and many of his sentries going over to the regulators, was reduced to comply with their requisition, and early the next morning repassed the Yadkin River with his cannon and baggage, the regulators agreeing to disperse and return to their several habitations. A council of war was held immediately to deliberate on the subject of the intelligence brought by the express, composed of the Honourable John Rutherford, Lewis de Rosset, Robert Palmer and Sam Cornell of His Majesty's Council, and the colonels and field officers of the army, wherein it was resolved that the army should change their route, get into the road at Captain Holt's that leads from Hillsborough to Salisbury, pass the Little and Great Alamance rivers with all possible expedition, and march without loss of time to join General Waddell. Accordingly, the army got under march, and before night encamped on the west side of Little Alamance, a strong detachment being sent forward to take possession of the west banks of Great Alamance, to prevent the enemy's parties from occupying that strong post. This evening, received intelligence that the regulators were sending scouts through all their settlements and assembling on Sandy Creek near Hunter's. Marched and joined the detachment on the west banks of Great Alamance, where a strong camp was chosen. Here the army halted till more provisions could be brought from Hillsborough, for which purpose several wagons now emptied and sent from camp to Hillsborough. Intelligence being brought this evening into camp that the rebels intended to attack the camp in the night, the necessary preparations were made for an engagement, and 1/3 of the army ordered to remain under arms all night, and the remainder to lay down near their arms. No alarm given. Tuesday, the 14th of May. Halted, the men ordered to keep in camp. The army lay on their arms all night, as in the preceding. No alarm. Wednesday, the 15th of May. About 6 o'clock in the evening, the governor received a letter from the insurgents which he laid before the Council of War, wherein it was determined that the army should march against the rebels early the next morning, that the governor should send them a letter offering them terms, and in case of refusal, should attack them. The men remained all night under arms. No alarm, though the rebels lay within 5 miles of the camp. From the Dream Book, Hillsborough, May 15th. Last night I fell asleep early and woke up before dawn inside a grey cloud. All day I felt like I was walking inside a mist. People talk to me and I don't hear them. I can see their mouths move and I nod and smile and then go away. The air is hot and muggy and everything smells like hot metal. My head aches and the cook is clanging pans. I've tried all day to remember what I dreamed of, and I can't. There's only grey and a feeling of fear. I've never been near a battle, but I have the feeling that what I'm dreaming of is cannon smoke. Chapter 60. Council of War. Jamie came back from the Council of War well after supper time, and informed the men briefly of Tryon's intent. The general response was approval, if not outright enthusiasm.
"It's good we move now," said Ewald Müller, stretching out his long arms and cracking all his knuckles simultaneously. "Longer we stay, we are growing moss."
This sentiment was greeted by laughter and nods of agreement. The mood of the company brightened noticeably at the prospect of action in the morning. Men settled down to talk around the fires, the rays of the setting sun glinting off tin cups and the polished barrels of the muskets laid carefully by their feet. Jamie made a quick round of inspection, answering questions and administering reassurances, then came to join me at our smaller fire. I looked at him narrowly.
In spite of the stress of the immediate situation, there was a sense of suppressed satisfaction about him that at once excited my suspicions.
"What have you done?"
I asked, handing him a large chunk of bread and a bowl of stew. He didn't bother denying that he'd been doing something.
"Got Cornell alone long enough after the council to ask him about Stephen Bonnet."
He ripped off a chunk of bread with his teeth and swallowed it with the minimum of chewing.
"Christ, I'm starved. I've not eaten all day, what with creeping through the brambles on my belly like a snake."
"Surely Samuel Cornell wasn't hanging about in the brambles."
Cornell was one of the Governor's Royal Council,
a stout and wealthy merchant from Edenton, and grossly unsuited by position, build and temperament for snaking through brambles.
"No, that was later."
He swapped the bread through the stew, took another enormous bite, then waved a hand, momentarily speechless. I handed him a cup of cider, which he used to wash down the mess.
"We were searching out the rebel lines," he explained. The obstruction cleared. "They're no far off, Ken. Though lines is giving them the benefit of considerable doubt," he added, scooping up more stew. "I've not seen such a rabble since I fought in France, and we took a village where a gang of wine smugglers were. Half of them whoring and all of them drunk. We had to pick them up off the ground to arrest them. This lot's little better from what I could see. Not so many whores, though," he added, "to be fair," and shoved the rest of his bread into his mouth.
"At least half of the governor's army was slightly the worse for drink at the moment, but that was so usual a condition as not to call for comment."
I gave him another piece of bread, concentrating on the important aspect of the conversation.
"So you found out something about Bonnet, then?"
He nodded, chewed, and gulped.
"Cornell's not met him, but he's heard talk. It seems he works his way up and down the outer banks for a bit, and then disappears for 3 or 4 months. Then suddenly, one day, he'll be there again, drinking in the taverns in Edenton or Roanoke, gold pieces spilling from his pockets."
"So he's bringing in goods from Europe and selling them?"
3 or 4 months was the time it would take to sail a ship to England and back.
"Contraband, I suppose."
Jamie nodded.
"Cornell thinks so. And you ken where he brings the stuff ashore."
He wiped the back of a hand across his mouth, seeming grimly amused.
"Wiley's Landing, or so rumour says."
"What? You don't mean Philip Wiley is in cahoots with him?"
I was shocked and rather distressed to hear this. But Jamie shook his head.
"As to that, I couldn't say. But the Landing adjoins Philip Wiley's plantation, to be sure. And the wee shite was wee Bonnet the night he came to River Run, no matter what he may have said about it later," he added.
He flapped a hand, dismissing Philip Wiley for the moment.
"But Cornell says that Bonnet's disappeared again. He's been gone this past month. So my aunt and Duncan are likely safe enough for the moment. That's one thing off my mind, and a good thing. There's enough to worry about without that."
He spoke without irony, glancing round at the encampment that sprawled around us. As the light failed, the fires began to glow through the dimness of twilight like hundreds of fireflies along the banks of Great Alamance.
"Herman's husband is here," he said.
I looked up from the fresh bowl of stew I was dishing out.
"Did you speak to him?"
He shook his head.
"I couldn't go near. He's with the regulators, aye. I was on a wee hill looking down across the stream and saw him in the distance. He was in a great mass of men, but I couldna mistake his dress."
"What will he do?"
I handed him the full bowl.
"Surely he won't fight, or allow them to fight."
I was inclined to view husband's presence as a hopeful sign. Herman Husband was the closest thing the regulators had to a real leader. They would listen to him, I was sure. Jamie shook his head, looking troubled.
"I dinna ken, Sassenach. He willna take up arms himself, no. But as for the rest..."
He trailed off, thinking. Then his face set in sudden decision. He handed me back the bowl, and turning on his heel, made his way across the camp. I saw him touch Roger on the shoulder and draw him aside a little. They spoke together for a few moments. Then Jamie reached into his coat, drew out something white, and handed it to Roger.
Roger looked at whatever it was for a moment, then nodded, and tucked it away in his own coat. Jamie clapped him on the shoulder, left him, and came back across the camp, pausing to laugh and exchange rude remarks with the Lindsay brothers. He came back smiling and took the bowl from me, seeming relieved.
"I've told Roger Mac to go first thing in the morning to find husband," he said, setting about the stew with renewed appetite. "If he can, I've told him to bring husband here, to speak face to face with Tryon. If he canna convince Tryon, which he can't, perhaps Tryon will convince husband that he's in earnest. If Herman sees it will mean bloodshed, then perhaps he will prevail upon his men to stand down."
"Do you really think so?" It had rained lightly in the afternoon, and banks of cloud still covered the eastern sky. The edges of those clouds glowed faintly red, not from the slanting rays of sunset, but from the fires of the regulators camped invisibly on the opposite bank of the Alamance. Jamie wiped his bowl and took a last bite of bread, shaking his head.
"I dinna ken," he said simply. "But there's nothing else to try, is there?"
I nodded and stooped to put more wood on the fire.
No one would sleep early tonight.
The campfires had burned all day, smoking and sputtering in a light rain. Now, though, the drizzle had ceased, and the clouds had parted, shredding into long, wispy mare's tails that glowed like fire across the whole arc of the western sky, eclipsing the puny efforts of the earthbound flames. Seeing it, I put a hand on Jamie's arm.
"Look," I said. He turned, wary lest someone had appeared at his heels with a fresh problem.
But his face relaxed as I gestured upward.
Frank, urged to look at some wonder of nature whilst preoccupied with a problem, would have paused just long enough not to seem discourteous, said, "Oh yes, lovely, isn't it?"
and returned at once to the maze of his thoughts. Jamie lifted his face to the glowing glory of the heavens and stood still. "What is the matter with you?" I thought to myself. "Can't you let Frank Randall rest in peace?" Jamie put an arm about my shoulders and sighed.
"In Scotland," he said, "the sky would be like lead all day, and even at the twilight you'd see no more than the sun sinking into the sea like a red-hot cannonball. Never a sky like this one is."
"What makes you think of Scotland?" I asked, intrigued that his mind should run as mine did on things of the past.
"Dawn and twilight and the season of the year," he said,
and his wide mouth curled slightly upward in reminiscence.
"Whenever there's a change in the air around me, it makes me think of what has been and what is now. I don't always do it in a house, but when I'm living rough, I'll often wake dreaming of folk I once knew, and then sit quiet in the twilight thinking of other times and places."
He shrugged a little.
"So now the sun is going down, and it is Scotland in my mind."
"Oh," I said, comforted at having such an explanation. "That must be it."
"Must be what?"
The setting sun bathed his face in gold, softening the lines of strain as he looked down at me. "I was thinking of other times and places too," I said, and leaned my head against his shoulder. "Just now, though, I can't think of anything but this."
"Oh?"
He hesitated for a moment, but then said carefully,
"I dinna much mention it, Sassenach, for if the answer's yes, there's nae so much I can do to mend it. But do you often long for the other times?"
I waited for the space of three heartbeats to answer. I heard them, Jamie's heart beating slow under my ear, and I curled my left hand closed, feeling the smooth metal of the gold ring on my finger. "No," I said, "but I remember them."
This ends Disc 27. The Fiery Cross, Disc 28.
Chapter 61.
Ultimatums. Great Alamance Camp,
May the 16th, 1771. To the people now assembled in arms who style themselves regulators. In answer to your petition, I'm to acquaint you that I have ever been attentive to the true interests of this country, and to that of every individual residing within it. I lament the fatal necessity to which you have now reduced me by withdrawing yourselves from the mercy of the Crown and the laws of your country, to require you are assembled as regulators to lay down your arms, surrender up the outlawed ringleaders, and submit yourselves to the laws of your country, and then rest on the lenity and mercy of the government. By accepting these terms in 1 hour from the delivery of this dispatch, you will prevent an effusion of blood, as you are at this time in a state of war and rebellion against your king, your country, and your laws. William Tryon. Jamie had gone before I woke. His blanket lay neatly folded beside me, and Gideon was gone from the pin-oak to which Jamie had tethered him the night before.
"Colonel's gone to meet with the Governor's Council of War,"
Kenny Lindsay told me, yawning widely. He blinked, shaking himself like a wet dog. "Tea, ma'am, or coffee?" "Tea, please." I supposed it was the tenor of current events that was causing me to think of the Boston Tea Party. I couldn't recall for sure when that brouhaha and its subsequent events were due to occur, but had an obscure feeling that I ought to seize every opportunity of drinking tea while it was still obtainable, in hopes of saturating my tissues, like a bear tucking into the grubs and berries in anticipation of winter. The day had dawned still and clear, and while it was cool for the moment, there was already a hint of mugginess in the air from the rain the day before. I sipped my tea, feeling small tendrils of hair escape from bondage to curl round my face, sticking to my cheeks in the steam from my cup. Tissues restored for the moment, I fetched a couple of buckets and set off for the stream. I hoped it wouldn't be needed, but it would be as well to have a quantity of boiled sterile water on hand just in case. And if it wasn't needed for medical purposes, I could rinse my stockings, which were much in need of attention. Despite its name, the Great Alamance wasn't a particularly impressive river, being no more than 15 or 20 feet across for most of its length. It was also shallow, mud-bottomed, and kinked like a wool ravelling, with multiple small arms and tributaries that wandered all over the landscape. I suppose it was a decent military demarcation, though. While a body of men could certainly ford the stream without much trouble, there was no chance of them doing so by stealth. Dragonflies darted over the water and over the heads of a couple of militiamen, chatting companionably as they relieved themselves into the murky waters of the stream. I paused tactfully behind a bush until they had left, reflecting as I made my way down the sloping bank with my buckets, how fortunate it was that most of the troops would consider drinking water only if actually dying of dehydration. When I came back into camp, I found it wide awake, every man alert, if red-eyed. The atmosphere was one of watchfulness, though, rather than immediate battle readiness, and there was no more than a general stir of interest when Jamie returned, Gideon threading his way past the campfires with surprising delicacy. "How is it, MacDoo?" Kenny asked, standing to greet him as Jamie reined up. "Anything ado?" Jamie shook his head. He was dressed with a neatness approaching severity, hair clubbed back, dirk and pistols fixed on his belt, sword at his side. A yellow cockade fixed to his coat was the only touch of decoration. "Battle ready," and a small frisson crept up my spine at the thought.
"The Governor's sent across his wee letter to the regulators. 4 sheriffs each took a copy. They're to read it out to every group they come across. We must just wait and see what happens."
I followed his glance toward the 3rd campfire. Roger had likely left as soon as it was light, before the camp woke. I had dumped the buckets into the kettle for boiling. I picked them up for another trip to the stream when Gideon's ears pricked and he lifted his head suddenly with a sharp whicker of greeting. Jamie instantly nudged the horse in front of me and his hand dropped to his sword. My view was blocked by Gideon's enormous chest and withers. I couldn't see who was coming, but I did see Jamie's hand relax its grip on the sword hilt as whoever it was came in sight. A friend, then.
or, if not precisely a friend, at least someone he didn't mean to run through or hack out of the saddle. I heard a familiar voice raised in greeting and peered out from under Gideon's chin to see Governor Tryon riding across the small meadow, accompanied by two aides. Tryon sat his horse decently, if without great style, and was dressed as usual for campaigning in a serviceable blue uniform coat and doeskin breeches, a yellow officer's cockade in his hat, and with one of the cavalry cutlasses called a hanger at his side. Not for show. The hilt showed nicks and the scabbard was worn. Tryon pulled up his horse and nodded, touching his hat to Jamie, who did likewise. Seeing me lurking in Gideon's shadow, the governor politely removed his cocked hat altogether, bowing from the saddle.
"Mrs. Fraser, your servant."
He glanced at the pails I held, then turned in his saddle, beckoning to one of his aides.
"Mr. Vickers, kindly help Mrs. Fraser, if you will."
I surrendered the pails gratefully to Mr. Vickers, a pink-cheeked young man of 18 or so, but instead of going with him, I simply directed him where to take them. Tryon raised one eyebrow at me, but I returned his expression of mild displeasure with a bland smile and stood my ground. I wasn't going anywhere. He was wise enough to recognise that and make no issue of my presence. Dismissing me instead from his cognizance, he nodded again to Jamie.
"Your troops are in order, Colonel Fraser."
He glanced pointedly around. The only troops visible at the moment were Kenny, who had his nose buried in his cup, and Murdo Lindsay and Geordie Chisholm, who were engaged in a vicious game of mumbletypeg in the shadows of the copse.
"Aye, sir."
The governor raised both brows in patent scepticism.
"Call them, sir. I will inspect their readiness."
Jamie paused for a moment, gathering up his reins. He squinted against the rising sun, evaluating the governor's mount.
"A nice gelding you have there, sir. Is he steady?" "Of course," the governor frowned. "Why?"
Jamie threw back his head and gave a ululating Highland cry of the sort meant to be heard over several acres of mountainside. The governor's horse jerked at the reins, eyes rolling back.
Militiamen poured out of the thicket, shrieking like banshees, and a black cloud of crows exploded from the trees above them like a puff of cannon smoke, raucous in flight. The horse reared, decanting Tryon in an undignified heap on the grass, and bolted for the trees on the far side of the meadow.
I took several steps backward, out of the way.
The governor sat up, purple-faced and gasping for breath, to find himself the centre of a ring of grinning militiamen, all pointing their weapons at him.
The governor glared into the barrel of the rifle poking into his face, and batted it away with one hand, making small choking noises like an angry squirrel. Jamie cleared his throat in a meaningful manner, and the men faded quietly back into the copse. I thought that on the whole it would be a mistake either to offer the governor a hand to arise or to let him get a look at my face. I tactfully turned my back and wandered a few steps away, affecting to have discovered an absorbing new plant springing from the ground near my feet. Mr. Vickers reappeared from the wood, looking startled, a pail of water in each hand. "What has happened?" He started toward the governor, but I put a hand on his sleeve to detain him. Best if Mr. Tryon had a moment to recover both his breath and his dignity. "Nothing important," I said, recovering my pails before he could spill them. How many militia troops are assembled here, do you know?"
1,068, ma'am," he said, looking thoroughly bewildered. "That is not accounting for General Waddell's troops, of course, but what..."
"And you have cannon?"
"Oh, yes, several, ma'am. We have two detachments with artillery, 2 6-pounders, 10 swivel guns, and 2 8-pound mortars.
Vickers stood a little straighter, important with the thought of so much potential destruction.
"There are 2,000 men across the creek, sir, but most of them barely armed. Many carry no more than a knife."
Jamie's voice came from behind me, drawing Vickers' attention away. I turned round to find that Jamie had dismounted, and was standing face to face with the governor, holding the latter's hat. He slapped it casually against his thigh and offered it back to its owner, who accepted it with as much grace as might be managed under the circumstances.
"I have been told as much, Mr. Fraser," he said dryly, "though I am pleased to hear that your intelligence corroborates my own. Mr. Vickers, will you be so kind as to go and fetch my horse?"
The purple hue had faded from Tryon's face, and while his manner still held a certain constraint, he seemed not to be holding a grudge. Tryon had both a sense of fairness and, more importantly at present, a sense of humour, both of which seemed to have survived the recent demonstration of military readiness. Jamie nodded.
"I suppose that your agents have also told you that the Regulators have no leader as such." "On the contrary, Mr. Fraser, I'm under the impression that Herman Husband is, and has been for some considerable time, one of the chief agitators of this movement. James Hunter, too, is a name that I've often seen appended to letters of complaint and the endless petitions that reach me in New Bern. And there are others. Hamilton, Gillespie."
Jamie made an impatient gesture, brushing a hovering cloud of gnats from his face.
"In some circumstances, sir, I should be willing to dispute with you whether the pen is mightier than the sword, but not on the edge of a battlefield, and that is where we stand. A boldness in writing pamphlets does not fit a man to lead troops, and Husband is a Quaker gentleman."
"I have heard as much," Tryon agreed.
He gestured toward the distant creek, one brow raised in challenge.
"And yet he is here."
"He is here," Jamie agreed. He paused for a moment, gauging the governor's mood before proceeding. The governor was tightly wound. There was no missing the tautness in his figure or the brightness of his eyes. Still, battle was not yet imminent, and the tension was well leashed. He could still listen.
"I have fed the man at my own hearth, sir," Jamie said carefully. "I have eaten at his. He makes no secret either of his views or his character. If he has come here today, I am certain that he has done so in torment of mind."
Jamie drew a deep breath. He was on dicey ground here.
"I've sent a man across the creek, sir, to find Husband and beg him to meet with me. It may be that I can persuade him to use his considerable influence to cause these men, these citizens..."
He gestured briefly toward the creek and the invisible myrmidons beyond.
"To abandon this disastrous course of action, which cannot but end in tragedy."
He met Tryon's eyes straight on.
"May I ask you, sir, may I beg of you, if Husband will come, will you not speak with him yourself?"
Tryon stood silent, oblivious of the dusty tricorn he turned around and around his hands. The echoes of the recent commotion had faded. A vireo sang from the branches of the elm above us.
"They are citizens of this colony," he said at last, with a nod in the direction of the creek. "I should regret that harm should come to them. Their grievances are not without merit. I have acknowledged as much publicly, and taken steps toward redress."
He glanced toward Jamie as though to see whether this statement was accepted. Jamie stood silent, waiting. Tryon took a deep breath and slapped the hat against his leg.
"Yet I am governor of this colony. I cannot see the peace disturbed, the law flouted, riot and bloodshed run rampant and unpunished."
He glanced bleakly at me.
"I will not."
He turned his attention back to Jamie.
"I think he will not come, sir. Their course is set."
He nodded once more toward the trees that edged Alamance Creek.
"And so is mine. Still..."
He hesitated for a moment, then made up his mind and shook his head.
"No. If he does come, then by all means reason with him, and if he will agree to send his men home peaceably, at that point bring him to me and we shall arrange terms. But I cannot wait upon the possibility."
Mr. Vickers had retrieved the governor's mount. The boy stood a little way apart, holding both horses by their reins, and I saw him nod slightly at this, as though affirming the governor's words. His own hat shaded him from the sun, yet his face was flushed and his eyes bright. He was eager for the fight. Tryon was not, yet he was ready. Neither was Jamie, but he was ready too. He held the governor's gaze for a moment, and then nodded, accepting inevitability.
"How long?" he asked quietly.
Tryon glanced upward at the sun, which stood a little short of mid-morning.
Roger had been gone for nearly 2 hours. How long might it take him to find Herman, husband, and return? "The companies are in battle order," Tryon said.
He glanced at the copse, and the corner of his mouth twitched. Then he returned a dark gaze to Jamie's face.
"Not long. Stand ready, Mr. Fraser."
He turned away, and clapping his hand on his head, seized the reins of his horse and swung into the saddle. He rode away without looking back, followed by his aides. Jamie watched him go, expressionless. I moved beside him, touching his hand. I didn't need to say that I hoped Roger would hurry. Chapter 62.
Stragglers and suspected persons. Item number 12. No officer or soldier to go beyond the limits of the camp, which is within the distance of the Grand Guard. Item number 63. Commanding officers of corps are to examine all stragglers and suspected persons, and those who cannot give a good account of themselves to be confined and report thereof made to headquarters.
Camp duties and regulations. Orders given out by His Excellency Governor Tryon to the provincials of North Carolina. Roger touched the pocket of his breeches, where he had tucked away his pewter militia badge. An inch and a half wide button of metal pierced round the edges, stamped with a crude FC for Fraser's Company, and meant to be sewn onto coat or hat. Such badges, and the cloth cockades, were the sole items of uniform for most of the governor's foot troops, and the only means of distinguishing a member of the militia from one of the regulators.
"And exactly how do you know whom to shoot?" he had inquired ironically when Jamie had handed him the badge at supper 2 days before. "If you get close enough to see the badge before you fire, won't the other bugger get you first?"
Jamie had given him a glance of equal irony, but courteously forbore any observations on Roger's marksmanship and the likelihood, or otherwise, of his doing any damage with his musket.
"I wouldn't wait to see myself," he said. "If anyone runs towards you with a gun, fire, and hope for the best."
A few men seated around the fire nearby sniggered at this, but Jamie ignored them. He reached for a stick and pulled 3 roasting yams out of the coals, so they lay side by side, black and steaming in the cool evening air. He kicked one gently, sending it rolling back into the ashes.
"That's us," he explained.
He kicked the next yam.
"That's Colonel Leach's company. And that,"
he booted the third, which rolled erratically after its fellows,
"is Colonel Ashes. Do you see?"
He cocked an eyebrow at Roger.
"Each company will go forward in its own path, so you're no likely to see any other militia, at least to begin with. Anyone coming toward us is most probably the enemy."
Then his long mouth curled up a bit as he gestured toward the men all round them, busy with their suppers.
"You ken every man here well enough. Well, dinna shoot any of them, and you'll be fine, eh?"
Roger smiled ruefully to himself as he made his way carefully down a slope covered with tiny yellow-flowered plants. It was sound advice. He was much less concerned with the possibility of being shot than with the fear of accidentally harming someone himself, including the not inconsiderable worry of blowing off a few of his own fingers. Privately, he was resolved not to fire at anyone, regardless either of circumstance or of the possibility of his hitting them. He'd heard enough of the regulator's stories, Abel McLennan, Herman's husband. Even allowing for the natural hyperbole of husband's style, his pamphlets burned with a sense of injustice that was inescapable. How could Roger look to kill a man or maim him only for protesting against abuses and corruption so blatant that they must offend any just-minded person? A trained historian,
He'd seen enough of present circumstances to understand just how widespread the problems were, how they'd come about, and he understood well enough the difficulties of correcting them. He sympathised with Tryon's position, to a point, but his sympathy stopped a good way short of rendering him a willing soldier in the cause of upholding the Crown's authority, still less the cause of preserving William Tryon's reputation and personal fortune. He stopped for a moment, hearing voices, and stepped softly behind the trunk of a large poplar. Three men came in sight a moment later, talking casually amongst themselves. All three had guns and bullet boxes, but the impression they gave was of three friends on their way to hunt rabbits, rather than grim troopers on the eve of battle. In fact, this appeared to be exactly what they were, foragers. One had a cluster of furry bodies slung from his belt, and another carried a muslin bag stained with something that might have been fresh blood. As Roger watched from the shelter of the poplar, one man stopped, hand out to check his comrades, who had both stiffened like hounds, noses pointing toward a clump of trees some 60 yards distant. Even knowing something was there, it took a moment before Roger spotted the small deer standing still against a grove of saplings, a veil of dappled light through the spring leaves overhead masking it almost perfectly from view. The first man swung his gun stealthily down from his shoulder, reaching for rod and cartridge. But one of the others stopped him with a hand on his arm. "Hold there, Abraham," said the second man, speaking softly but clearly. "You don't want to be firing so close to the creek. You heard what the colonel said. Regulators are drawn right up to the bank near that point." He nodded toward the heavy growth of alder and willow that marked the edge of the invisible creek no more than 100 yards distant. "You don't want to be provoking them, not just now." Abraham nodded reluctantly and put up his gun again. "Aye, I suppose. Will it be today, do you think?" Roger glanced back at the sapling grove, but the deer had vanished, silent as smoke. "Can't see how it won't be." The third man pulled a yellow kerchief from his sleeve and wiped his face. The weather was warm and the air muggy. "Tryon's had his guns in place since dawn. He's not the man to let anybody get a jump on him. He might wait for Waddell's men, but he may think he's no need of them." Abraham snorted with mild contempt. "To crush those rabble? Seen them, have you? A poorer set of soldiers you'd not seen among the Sundays." The man with the kerchief smiled cynically. "Well, that's as may be, Abbey. Seen some of the backcountry militia, have you? Speaking of rabble. And speaking of the regulators, there's a lot of them, rabble or not. 2 to 1, Captain Neil says." Abraham grunted, casting a last reluctant glance toward the wood and the creek beyond. "Rabble," he repeated more confidently, and turned away. "Come along, then, let's have a look upslope." The foragers were on the same side as himself. They wore no cockades, but he saw the militia badge on breast and hat glinting silver in the morning sun. Still, Roger remained in the shadows until the men had vanished, talking casually amongst themselves. He was reasonably sure that Jamie had sent him on this mission with no authority beyond his own. Best if he were not asked to explain himself. The attitude amongst most of the militia toward the regulation was at best scornful. At worst, at the upper levels of command, it was coldly vindictive.
"Crush them, once and for all," Caswell had said over a cup of coffee by the fire the night before. A plantation owner from the eastern part of the colony, Richard Caswell had no sympathy with the regulators' grievances.
Roger patted his pocket again, considering. No, best leave it. He could produce the badge if he were challenged, and he didn't think anyone would shoot him in the back without at least a shout of warning. Still, he felt oddly exposed as he walked through the lush grass of the river meadow, and sighed with involuntary relief as the languishing branches of the creekside willows enfolded him in cool shadow. He had, with Jamie's approval, left his musket behind and come unarmed, save for the knife at his belt that was a normal accoutrement for any man. His only other item of equipment was a large white kerchief presently folded up inside his coat.
"If you should be threatened, anywhere, wave it and cry truce," Jamie had instructed him. Then tell them to fetch me and dinna say any more until I come. If no one prevents you, bring me husband under its protection.
The vision of himself leading Herman husband back across the creek, holding the flapping kerchief on a stick above his head like a guide leading tourists through an airport, made him want to hoot with laughter. Jamie hadn't laughed, though, or even smiled, and so he had accepted the cloth solemnly, tucking it away with care. He peered through the screen of drooping leaves, but the creek ran past sparkling in the day's new sun, silent save for the rush of water past stones and clay. No one was in sight, and the noise of the water drowned any sound that might have come from beyond the trees on the other side. While the militia might not shoot him in the back, he wasn't so sanguine about the possibilities of regulators shooting him from the front if they saw him crossing from the government side. Still, he couldn't skulk in the trees all day. He emerged onto the bank and made his way downstream toward the point the foragers had indicated, watching the trees carefully for any signs of life. The crossing near the point was better, shallow water and a rocky bottom. Still, if the regulators were drawn up anywhere nearby, they were being damned quiet about it. A more peaceful scene could scarcely be imagined, and yet his heart was hammering suddenly in his ears. He had again the odd feeling of someone standing near him. He glanced around in all directions, but nothing moved save the rushing water and the trailing willow fronds. "That you, Dad?" he said softly under his breath, and at once felt foolish. Still, the feeling of someone near remained strong, though benign. With a mental shrug, he bent and took off his shoes and stockings. It must be the circumstances, he thought. Not that one could quite compare wading a shallow creek in search of a Quaker rabble-rouser to flying a Spitfire across the night-time channel on a bombing run to Germany. A mission was a mission, though, he supposed. He looked round once again, but saw only tadpoles wriggling in the shallows. With a slightly crooked smile, he stepped into the water, sending the tadpoles into frenzied flight.
"Over the top, then," he said to a wood duck.
The bird ignored him, going on with its foraging among the dark green rafts of floating cress. No challenge came from the trees on either side. No sounds at all, bar the cheerful racket of nesting birds. It was as he sat on a sun-warmed rock, drying his feet before putting his shoes and stockings back on, that he finally heard some indication that the far side of the creek was populated by humans.
"So what do you want then, sweeting?"
The voice came from the shrubbery behind him, and he froze, blood thundering in his ears. It was a woman's voice. Before he could move or think to answer, though, he heard a laugh, deeper in pitch, and with a particular tone to it that made him relax. Instinct informed him before his reason did that voices with that particular intonation were not a threat.
"Dunno, innie. What will it cost me?" "Oh, hark at him. Not the time to count your pennies, is it?" "Don't you worry, ladies. We'll take up a collection amongst us if we have to." "Oh, is that the way of it? Well and good, sir, but be you aware in this congregation the collection comes before the singing."
Listening to this amiable wrangling, Roger deduced that the voices in question belonged to three men and two women, all of whom seemed confident that whatever the financial arrangements, three would go into two quite evenly, with no awkward remainders. Picking up his shoes, he stole quietly away, leaving the unseen sentries, if that's what they were, to their sums. Evidently the army of the regulation wasn't quite so organised as the government troops. Less organised was putting it mildly, he thought, a little later. He had kept to the creek bank for some distance, unsure where the main body of the army might be. He had walked nearly a quarter mile, with neither sight nor sound of a soul other than the two whores and their customers. Feeling increasingly surreal, he wandered through small pine groves and across the edges of grassy meadows, with no company save courting birds and small gossamer butterflies in shades of orange and yellow.
"What the hell sort of way is this to run a war?" he muttered,
shoving his way through a blackberry bramble. It was like one of those science fiction stories in which everyone but the hero had suddenly vanished from the face of the earth. He was beginning to be anxious. What if he didn't manage to find the bloody Quaker, or even the army, before the shooting started? Then he rounded a bend in the creek and caught his first glimpse of the regulators proper, a group of women washing clothes in the rushing waters by a cluster of boulders. He ducked back into the brush before they should see him, and turned away from the creek, heartened. If the women were here, the men weren't far away. They weren't. Within a few more yards he heard the sounds of camp, casual voices, laughter, the clank of spoons and tea kettles, and the clunk of splitting wood. Rounding a clump of hawthorn, he was nearly knocked over by a gang of young men who ran past, hooting and yelling as they chased one of their number, who brandished a fresh-cut raccoon's tail overhead, floating in the breeze as he ran. They charged past Roger without a second glance, and he went on, a bit less warily. He wasn't challenged. There were no sentries. In fact, a strange face appeared to be neither a novelty nor a threat. A few men glanced casually at him, but then turned back to their talk, seeing nothing odd in his appearance. "I'm looking for Herman Husband," he said bluntly to a man roasting a squirrel over the pale flames of a fire. The man looked blank for a moment. "The Quaker," Roger amplified.
"Oh, aye, him," the man said, features clearing. "He's a ways beyond, that way, I think."
He gestured helpfully with his stick, the charred squirrel pointing the way with the stubs of its blackened forelegs. A ways beyond was some way. Roger passed through three more scattered camps before reaching what looked to be the main body of the army, if one could dignify it by such a term. True, there did seem to be an increasing air of seriousness. There was less of the carefree frolicking that he had seen near the creek. Still, it wasn't Strategic Command headquarters by a long shot. He began to feel mildly hopeful that violence could still be avoided, even with the armies drawn up face to face and the gun crews standing by. There had been an air of excited readiness among the militia as he passed through their lines, but no atmosphere of hatred or bloodthirstiness. Here, the situation was far different than it was among the orderly militia lines, but even less disposed to immediate hostilities. As he pressed on further, though, asking his way at each campfire he passed, he began to feel something different in the air, a sense of increasing urgency, almost of desperation. The horseplay he'd seen in the outer camps had vanished, men clustered, talking in close groups, their heads together, or sat by themselves, grimly loading guns and sharpening knives. As he got closer, the name of Herman Husband was recognised by everyone, the pointing fingers surer of direction. The name seemed almost a magnet, pulling him farther and farther into the centre of a thickening mass of men and boys, all excited, all armed. The noise grew greater all the time, voices beating on his ears like hammers on a forge. He found Husband at last, standing on a rock like a large grey wolf at bay, surrounded by a knot of some 30 or 40 men, all clamouring in angry agitation, elbows jabbed and feet trampled without regard to impact on their fellows. Clearly they were demanding an answer, but unable to pause long enough to hear one were it given. Husband, stripped to his shirt sleeves and red in the face, was shouting at one or two of those closest to him. But Roger could hear nothing of what was said above the general hubbub. He pushed through the outer ring of spectators, but was stopped nearer the centre by the press of men. At least here he could pick up a few words.
"We must! You know it, Herman, there's no choice!" shouted a lanky man in a battered hat. "There is always a choice," Husband bellowed back. "Now is the time to choose, and God send we do it wisely." "Aye, with cannon pointed at us? No, no. Forward, we must go forward, or all is lost. Lost! We've lost everything so far. We must—" "The governor's taken choice from us. We must, we must, we must."
All single words were lost in a general roar of anger and frustration. Seeing that there was nothing to be gained by waiting for an audience, Roger shoved his way ruthlessly between two farmers and seized Husband by the sleeve of his shirt.
"Mr. Husband, I must speak with you," he shouted in the Quaker's ear.
Husband gave him a glazed sort of look and made to shake him off, but then stopped, blinking as he recognised him. The square face was flushed with colour above the sprouting beard, and Husband's coarse grey hair, unbound, bristled out from his head like the quills of a porcupine. He shook his head and shut his eyes, then opened them again, staring at Roger like a man seeking to dispel some impossible vision, and failing. He grabbed Roger's arm, and with a fierce gesture at the crowd, leapt down from his rock and made off toward the shelter of a ramshackle cabin that leaned drunkenly in the shade of a maple grove. Roger followed, glaring round at those nearest to discourage pursuit. A few followed, nonetheless, waving arms and expostulating hotly. But Roger slammed the door in their faces and dropped the bolt, placing his back against the door for good measure. It was cooler inside, though the air was stale and smelt of wood ash and burnt food. Husband stood panting in the middle of the floor, then picked up a dipper and drank deeply from a bucket that stood upon the hearth, the only object left in the cabin, Roger saw. Husband's coat and hat hung neatly on a hook by the door, but bits of rubbish were scattered across the packed earth floor. Whoever owned the cabin had evidently decamped in haste, carrying their portable belongings. Calmed by the moment's respite, Husband straightened his rumpled shirt and made shift to tidy his hair.
"What does thee here, friend Mackenzie?" he asked with characteristic mildness. "Thee does not come to join the cause of regulation, surely?"
"Indeed I do not," Roger assured him.
He cast a wary eye at the window, lest the crowd try to gain access that way. But while the rumble of voices outside continued their argument, there was no immediate sound of assault upon the building.
"I've come to ask if you will go across the creek with me, under a flag of truce. Your safety is assured. To speak with Jimmy Fraser."
Husband glanced at the window too.
"I fear the time for speaking has long past," he said, with a wry twist of the lips.
Roger was inclined to think so too, but pressed on, determined to fulfil his commission.
"Not so far as the governor is concerned. He has no wish to slaughter his own citizenry. If the mob could be convinced to disperse peaceably."
"Does it seem to thee a likely prospect?"
Husband waved at the window, giving him a cynical glance.
"No," Roger was forced to admit.
"Still, if you would come, if they could see that there were still some possibility of... If there were possibilities of reconciliations and redress, it should have been offered long since," Husband said sharply. "Is this a token of the governor's sincerity, to come with troops and cannon, to send a letter that..."
"Not redress," Roger said bluntly.
"I meant the possibility of saving all your lives."
Husband stood quite still. The ruddy colour faded from his cheeks, though he still looked composed.
"Has it come to that?" he asked quietly,
his eyes on Roger's face. Roger took a deep breath and nodded.
"There's not much time. Mr. Fraser bid me tell you, if you could not come to speak with him yourself,
there are two companies of artillery arrayed against you and eight of militia, all well armed. All lies in readiness, and the governor will not wait past dawn of tomorrow, at the latest."
He was aware that it was treason to give such information to the enemy. But it was what Jamie Fraser would have said, could he have come himself.
"There are near 2,000 men of the regulation here," Husband said, as though to himself. 2,000? Would thee not think the sight of it would sway him? That so many would leave home and hearth and come in protest? It is the governor's opinion that they come in rebellion, therefore in a state of war," Roger interrupted.
He glanced at the window where the oiled parchment covering hung in tatters.
"And having seen them, I must say that I think he has reasonable grounds for that opinion."
"It is no rebellion," Husband said stubbornly.
He drew himself up and pulled a worn black silk ribbon from his pocket with which to tie back his hair.
"But our legitimate complaints have been ignored, disregarded. We have no choice but to come as a physical body to lay our grievances before Mr. Tryon and thus impress him with the rightness of our objection.
I thought I heard you speak of choice a few moments past, Roger said dryly. And if now is the time to choose,